On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They stood in the Rose Garden. They didn't shake hands. Then Afghan President Hamid Karzai and Pakistan's Pervez Musharraf sat down last night for a 2.5-hour dinner with George Bush. It may have been a long 2.5 hours. Musharraf said in the U.S. this week that Karzai is an ostrich with his head in the sand. Karzai has suggested Pakistan is playing with snakes in its soft handling of a resurgent Taliban and failure to cough up Osama bin Laden. And George Bush is staring at a bloody Taliban comeback that threatens to push America's one big war on terror victory claim out of the win column. Up next on Point, Bush, Karzai, Musharraf, and big trouble in Afghanistan. We turn first to Ron Moreau in Islamabad, Pakistan. He's South Asia Bureau Chief for Newsweek and co-author of this week's story, cover story around the world, but not in the U.S., headlined The Rise of Jihadistan. Ron, thanks for being with us. What's Jihadistan?
Oh, hi, Tom. Well, Jihadistan is a wide, wide, wide swath of territory that runs from well inside the Pakistan border almost over to the Iranian border and encompassing most of south and southeastern and southwestern Afghanistan. And it's a place where the Taliban have really come back in the last year, and where al-Qaeda has, strengthened its foothold there.
How has the Taliban made such a comeback? U.S. forces have been there for years now. NATO's in there. We hear about them arming up and getting tougher. What's going on that's put the Taliban back in the spotlight?
Well, I think it was a failure of U.S. policy from the beginning. We went into Afghanistan thinking we could do things really on the cheap, with very few forces on the ground, and by relying on Afghan warlords who had already been overthrown by the Taliban because of their misrule during the 1990s, and who came back with U.S. support. Then the U.S. sent in certainly not enough troops that only basically had a heavy footprint on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border, and they left most of the rest of the country certainly for the Taliban to regroup in. And the Taliban also took advantage of the lack of firm policy action by the Musharraf government in the tribal areas in Pakistan to regroup there as well and to recruit from some of the radical madrasas or Islamic schools that are just all along the border.
Ron, I think you've got to paint a picture for us of what's happening to control and influence in Afghanistan and along that border. I mean, back in the States, rhetorically at least, Afghanistan still sits, I think, in most people's minds in the win column for the U.S. here. So what exactly is going on the ground? What does President Karzai and the government the U.S. has backed, what do they control? What don't they control? How strong is the Taliban? What's the evidence?
Well, I think that the Karzai administration, especially in the contested areas in the south and the southeast, basically only control the towns and the so-called cities, which aren't very big, and the district towns. And the Taliban have re-infiltrated from Pakistan and from their base areas in the mountains in Afghanistan back into the countryside. And they've mounted, military campaigns against government forces and U.S. forces, and they've tried to overturn some of the pluses that had happened over the last few years. So they burned girl schools as well as boys schools. They've stopped any economic development from happening. They've assassinated development workers, kidnapped them, and they're trying just to disrupt the whole situation. And the Karzai administration has been basically very inept, and most of its representatives on the ground in the districts and in the provinces are abusing their power and are corrupt. And the United States, I think, the United States military was very late to realize just how bad the misgovernance was on the ground in Afghanistan. And all of this has just allowed the Taliban to militarily come back and to get somewhat of a political foothold there as well.
Still have 40,000 U.S. and NATO troops there, but you quote General Eikenberry at the top of the U.S. effort there saying, you know, you reach a tipping point where military superiority no longer counts as much. What are we talking about here? Is Afghanistan, the whole thing, at risk of going back to the Taliban, or is this simply, and I don't mean merely, but is this just a kind of a stronghold in the mountains? Does it mean al-Qaeda has a new base? Are they once again being hosted by the Taliban there?
Well, I don't think the Taliban are going to, are in any position to have a military breakthrough or certainly a military victory anytime soon. But the fact is that they are in a very strong position now to disrupt any kind of efforts, especially in terms of winning hearts and minds and economic development efforts that the government, the U.S. And NATO try to do. And they've been very successful, I think, in you know, kind of turning the psychological tide, where so Afghans are so upset about the lack of security and the extent of the war that they're kind of willing to you know, to side with anybody who will give them security. And right now, in the countryside, the Taliban seem to say, "Look, you know, we can give you security." So it's a very difficult situation for us right now.
And Ron, where you sit in Islamabad, what does it look like? Whose side is Pakistan on?
Well, I think, you know, Musharraf has a two-faced game going. On the one hand, he has a face to the West and to his allies in the West that, you know, he's on our side, that he's against the Taliban and he's fighting al-Qaeda. On the other hand, within Pakistan, he is and his administration and his political party are siding very closely with the very Islamic militants that we probably want to combat. So, you know, he's trying to have it both ways. But the problem is, by trying to have it both ways, there's just not the success being brought about that Washington or indeed, you know, Afghanistan would like to see happen.
Ron, thanks very much for the report from Islamabad. Ron Moreau is South Asia Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. I want to turn to Washington now for the view from the Capitol and an early read on last night's working dinner at the White House. We turn to Carol Giacomo, diplomatic correspondent for Reuters in Washington. Carol, thanks for being with us again. Is there any news about what came out of this big dinner last night?
Well, so far we still have only sketchy reports, but according to the White House and White House officials, the two leaders, Karzai and Musharraf, while they may not have shook hands when the cameras...
In the Rose Garden, yep.
Right. They did shake hands by the end of the night. I think that's a slim read on which to sort of pin your hopes, though. There, as Ron had indicated, there are very serious differences between these two. The Bush had hoped that by getting them around a table that he could... you know, sort of encourage some personal chemistry between the two men, focus on where they have common issues, common challenges, and ways that they could work together. And indeed, the White House statement that came out late last night suggests that they did, in fact, recommit themselves to trying to defeat terrorism, to share intelligence, and to, you know, work for other common efforts. But it's all rhetoric right now, and we'll have to see whether they can actually do anything on the ground.
A lot of interests at play here as well. Carol, what's your sense within the Bush administration? I mean, we're reading very alarmist analyses coming out of Afghanistan and Pakistan right now. Is there a sense in Washington, in the administration, that they've got a five-alarm fire in Afghanistan or steady as she goes? How are they reading it?
No, I think they're becoming more and more alarmed. But you also have to see that this administration has a lot of fires going in Iraq. As you said, in Afghanistan, they have this huge nuclear problem with Iran that remains a problem. They have the Arab Palestinian-Israeli crisis, which is getting more attention because of the war in Lebanon. So they've got a lot of balls in the air, so to speak. In terms of Afghanistan and Pakistan, I do think that, especially, you know, as we're in the run-up to the election,
mm-hmm.
and you have media reports day in and day out about how, as Ron indicated, you know, people thought Afghanistan was pretty much done, and clearly that's not the case. Meanwhile, you have increasing reports about, or daily reports about, the devastation in Iraq. So it's a pretty heavy diet of bad news.
Carol, thanks for being with us. On Tuesday, Pakistani President Musharraf appeared on CNN's Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer, and he blamed Afghan President Karzai squarely and undiplomatically for the Taliban resurgence.
He is not oblivious. He knows everything, but he's purposely denying, turning a blind eye like an ostrich. He doesn't want to tell the world what is the fact for his own personal reasons. This is what I think.
The next day, yesterday, Blitzer had the Afghan president, Karzai, on the show, and he played back Musharraf's comments. Here's what Karzai said.
He's right to say that I know the facts. I indeed know the facts. But I also know a lot of facts in Pakistan. And that's why I'm pleading with President Musharraf that for the sake of security for all of us and for our allies, it is extremely important to pay serious attention and take action against some of the places called madrasas that are not madrasas, that are training extremists full of hatred for the rest of the world.
Those are religious madrasas, are religious schools in Pakistan. And what is your charge that President Musharraf is what? Not doing enough to stop that religious training?
Not doing enough at all. And I want all of us to take more action.
Hamid Karzai and Wolf Blitzer on CNN. What do you think? Do we already have jihadistan on the Afghan-Pakistan border? I want to turn to New York and Barnett Rubin, senior fellow in New York University's Center on International Cooperation. He served as special advisor to the UN Special Representative of the Secretary General for Afghanistan, Lakhdar Brahimi, in 2001. He's author of Blood on the Doorstep. Barnett Rubin, thank you very much for being with us. What's going on here?
Well, thanks, Tom. I want to address two big misconceptions that I've heard in these discussions so far.
Please.
The first is that the problem in Afghanistan is primarily a military problem, and that the question is all about should we have more troops or less troops. It's not primarily a military problem, and the first people who would tell you that are the soldiers.
We quoted General Eikenberry saying there's a tipping point where military superiority no longer counts so much.
That's right. And at most, military superiority can create conditions for the political and economic action that you have to have. So the failure in policy was not primarily one of not enough troops. It was one of not putting in enough aid and the right kind of aid to help strengthen the government of Afghanistan and strengthen the governance along the border in Pakistan so that the people mm-hmm. there could provide security for themselves. Mm-hmm. We did it very much on the cheap. Remember, Afghanistan, nobody remembers this, is one of the five poorest countries in the world. The revenue of the government of Afghanistan is $11 per person per year. That's
wow.
its resources.
Wow.
Second is the misconception that this is about two leaders bickering. It is not about two leaders bickering. It's about two countries that have different national interests. Everything in that region is not about our war on terror. Everything there is not about us. Afghanistan and mm-hmm. Pakistan have had hostile relations for as long as both countries have existed because of issues with respect to the border, with respect to their international mm-hmm. alignments. And what is happening between those two leaders is not something personal. It's a result of those very different political interests. Now, let me give you an example. You talked about intelligence cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
The intelligence agency in Afghanistan, the head of that intelligence agency, is a former aide to Ahmad Shah Massoud. He was Ahmad Shah Massoud's, that is the commander of the Northern Alliance, who was assassinated mm-hmm. on September 9, 2001.
Right.
He was his liaison with the CIA, and he is also from Panjshir.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout his talks in the United States, and I heard President Musharraf speak at the Council on Foreign Relations,
right.
he has denounced the Afghan government for being dominated by people from Panjshir. Now, what he means by that is people who are influenced by India. President Musharraf has said that there is Indian penetration in the intelligence agency and the Ministry of Defense of Afghanistan.
And that Pakistan can barely live with.
That's right. Pakistan told us in 2001 they couldn't live with it.
Because they're afraid of being sort of surrounded by Indian influence there.
Exactly. Now, I don't accept that charge on his part. But it means that Pakistan is looking at this whole situation with regard to its basic security issue, which is its confrontation with India, not with respect to the war on terror, which is our basic security issue.
But Barnett Rubin, can we back up for one moment? I want to dig into both of these areas on aid and on the interests that are really at play here. But first, I'd love to just get your assessment of where things stand here. Is Karzai at the head of a government that's stable? Could we see the kind of dissolution of order that would in fact bring, or has it already, bring the Taliban back to wide influence? Could we see the reestablishment? And I understand there are other interests at work here, but in the midst of that, the reestablishment of an actual al-Qaeda base here?
Well, those are different questions. The Karzai government is extremely weak and does not have effective tools to control most of the country. And that is a result of the dissolution of the state in Afghanistan over the past several decades and our lack of, you know, and our insufficient assistance to try to rebuild that state. Now, as long as the international troops are in the country, the Taliban are not going to be able to capture control of major cities, let alone the capital. The danger is that they will so hollow out the government by killing its officials, intimidating people, and so on, that basically we will not have any effective allies there, and we will increasingly become an occupation force. And the more that happens, the more we inevitably will lose.
How far are we toward that situation today? Near, far, halfway there?
I can't characterize it in that sense, but a crisis could bring us much closer to that, and such crises could happen for various reasons. Now, then you have the Pakistan side of the border that Afghanistan doesn't recognize. And here, now, the al-Qaeda people, and of course, al-Qaeda people are outsiders, and they have a very different agenda from the Taliban. The Taliban had a basically national or Afghan-Pakistan agenda, not an anti-U.S. one. Now, because
of
the war in Iraq,
they hosted al-Qaeda willingly and openly.
Yes, but actually, al-Qaeda deceived them about what they were doing.
Okay,
they were not full partners. And you will find some Taliban people who are rather bitter about that today. But on the other hand, the Taliban have seen the way the U.S. behaved invading Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11. And unfortunately, this has tended to validate some of the things that al-Qaeda told them about the United States, which they hadn't believed before. Therefore, they have become closer to al-Qaeda. And they've also received more assistance from it, and especially from Iraq.
Well, I want to turn to how the Taliban sees it and the Pakistanis. But just on this point, for clarity here, is it your view that if the Taliban reestablishes areas of influence, control, and they apparently are, does that necessarily mean jihadistan is emerging? That's Newsweek's headline, that there's a new, you know, petri dish here for international terrorism to be hosted in, or not?
It's a good headline, but you shouldn't make policy on the basis of headlines. The jihadistan issue has more to do with Waziristan. Now, Waziristan is in Pakistan. Yes. But it's not ruled by Pakistan. You see, there's an area which is called the Federally Administered Tribal Agencies, where Pakistan does not have administrative control, though it's part of Pakistan, and Afghanistan doesn't recognize Pakistan control over those areas. In that area, there are some commanders of Taliban and also some foreign jihadis, more or less linked to al-Qaeda, who have been living there and using it as a base to fight in Afghanistan. The Pakistan army entered that area and fought them. And actually, the Taliban initiated truce negotiations because they wanted to focus the energies on Afghanistan. Pakistan is now portraying this as a deal with tribal elders under which they agree not to fight in Afghanistan. And that is what the deal says. But U.S. intelligence on the ground says that since the deal has been signed, the number of attacks coming from that area has tripled. So it seems to have created a sanctuary for the Taliban.
So does that mean, in your view, that Musharraf is indeed a kind of a two-faced or leader here? Is he bluffing in the United States when he says he's an ally? How do you read his agenda, his motives?
Well, the whole rhetoric about you're with us or against us, it disables us intellectually from understanding people, because he's not sitting there thinking, am I with the United States or am I against it? He's thinking what's best for Pakistan, as I understand it. And now what he wants to do is he doesn't want the Taliban to become powerful in Pakistan and take over Pakistan. That is not his agenda. He doesn't want al-Qaeda to attack the United States or Great Britain. That's not his agenda. But he also doesn't want a government of Afghanistan, which has strong influence from the Northern Alliance and is closely aligned with India. Therefore, he is helping the United States international community in finding al-Qaeda people in Pakistan, and he has done a lot on that, mm-hmm. who are interested in attacking the U.S. and Great Britain, while at the same time he is doing essentially nothing about Taliban, who are fighting across the border in Afghanistan, putting pressure on the Afghan government to remove Indian influence.
So if we wanted to get toward a situation of some stability here, which would presumably favor U.S. interest in that it wouldn't be an environment for international terrorism to be bred, what are the planks, as you see them, that would require from where we stand today?
Well, first of all, the United States has to communicate clearly to President Musharraf that it is not acceptable to harbor or even passively allow the leadership of groups that are killing Americans, killing NATO soldiers, killing Afghan civilians and Afghan troops.
But surely Washington has said that. I mean, he said they threatened to bomb him back to the Stone Age years ago when they went into Afghanistan. It's no longer a tough message?
That was over something else. That mm-hmm. was over helping them fight al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. I don't believe they actually said that either. But mm-hmm. besides that, that's a different issue. He did allow the United States to have access to Pakistan to destroy al-Qaeda and the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a different issue. He still is permitting that, but there are safe havens for Taliban operating within Pakistan from Quetta, the capital of Balochistan, and the tribal areas. We have not indicated that is an obstacle to our military supply relationship, as far as I know. But that's not enough, because, as I said, Pakistan mm-hmm. has some concerns, which may not be fully realistic, but they're based on something legitimate. That is, Pakistan does have a conflict with India. Therefore, we have to do some things to try to lessen the perception of threat that Pakistan has from Indian influence in Afghanistan. I could go into detail on what those are, but I won't do that now. I must say one other thing is... that there are issues about the border, which Afghanistan doesn't mm-hmm. recognize, the role of the tribes on both sides. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it reported yet, but I understand from Afghan sources to whom I've spoken this morning that the two presidents did reach an agreement to hold tribal jirgas on both sides of the border, mm-hmm. In both the eastern area around Waziristan and the Afghan provinces of Paktia and Khost, and in the south, in Pakistani Balochistan and the Afghan province of Kandahar, and that these tribal jirgas would be attended by both President Karzai and President Musharraf, which would be a strong signal that they want to enlist the support of the tribes on both sides of the border in stabilizing the situation that the two presidents are in this together.
So this may be a sign of progress, but as you point out, the number of attacks is up significantly since this agreement, and you're describing a picture where the U.S. has looked at this through a war on terror lens, but the local players have long-term interests here that are maybe deeper-seated than those. Barnett Rubin, a lot of listeners want to join this conversation. Let me turn, if I may, to Nashville, Tennessee, and John. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hello. I have a couple of comments and then a question.
Yes.
Looking at the history of Pakistan and this conflict, the BBC reported that in 2005, Pakistan funneled $500,000 to al-Qaeda. Also in 2005, the Daily Times newspaper of Pakistan reported that a Pakistani general gave a shoot-to-kill order for any American troops that might cross the border from Afghanistan. Also, the Times of India in 2002 reported that General Mahmoud Ahmed, the head of Pakistani intelligence, had actually had $100,000 wired to Muhammad Atta, the lead hijacker.
So you're reading widely and you're finding evidence, it sounds like, of Pakistani, not a good ally, I guess.
Exactly. So it seems to me, because also the Asian Times reported that Pakistan nuclear scientists had been meeting with al-Qaeda to, quote-unquote, discuss peaceful use of nuclear technology.
So take us to your question out of all that, John.
So my question is, did we invade the wrong country when we invaded Iraq? Maybe we should have invaded Pakistan.
Barnett Rubin?
First of all, there are a lot of different ways to handle international problems other than invasions. Hmm. So we shouldn't have invaded either of those two countries.
Seriously? Even though bin Laden was standing there?
No, he said Iraq and Pakistan.
Oh, excuse me. Okay.
The action against Afghanistan was legitimate, and it was welcomed by most of the people of Afghanistan, even though they're now quite disappointed in the results. But, you know, invading Pakistan was and is not a good idea. Now, I don't know about all those reports. I've heard some of them. They're not confirmed. If you look around the internet, you can pick up a lot of raw intelligence, disinformation, semi-facts, and so on. But it is true that Pakistan historically, they supported the Taliban. General Musharraf has admitted that. They actually used al-Qaeda as well to help train people to fight in Kashmir. Using jihadi extremists has been an instrument of Pakistani policy. By the way, with the support of the United States since the 1970s. Now, because they were using
them
against...
When the Soviets were there. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, let's not think that we're entirely blameless either. We built up their capacity to do that. They use that as a force multiplier. Because India is 8 times larger than they are. They have kept 700,000 Indian troops tied down in Kashmir at a very low cost by having them trained in Afghanistan under the Taliban by al-Qaeda, and then just sending them to fight in Kashmir. And then they use nuclear weapons to prevent, to make sure that India cannot retaliate in a conventional way.
But with all that in Afghanistan, could the U.S. face the same fate as the Soviets here? Meat grinder driven out.
Of course, that's possible. There are many other scenarios. But bear in mind that the Soviet Union was politically isolated in Afghanistan. We have the support not only of NATO, but in effect of the United Nations and the entire international community. And we also have, at least verbally, the support of Pakistan and all the neighbors of Afghanistan, including, by the way, Iran, although they have some differences with how we are conducting this. The question is, we have not taken into account fully certain concerns that Pakistan has and certain concerns that Afghanistan has, which are not all related to terrorism. And we have to address those long-term regional security interests if we want to be successful. So there are certainly risks of failing. Commander Abdul Haq, who was killed by the Taliban in October 2001, once said, there's a British graveyard in Afghanistan, there's a Soviet graveyard in Afghanistan, and there will be an American graveyard in Afghanistan. Well, there is an American graveyard, and also now Canadian, British, Dutch, and so on.
In the midst of his high-stakes visit over the last week, President Musharraf has also been out on the celebrity hustings, promoting his just-released memoir, In the Line of Fire. On Wednesday, viewers of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart were treated to an almost eerie conversation where guest and host joked about tea and terrorism and a hypothetical election with President Bush and Osama bin Laden running for office in Pakistan.
Let's say if there were an election held in Pakistan today, and not clearly for your job because you're doing a wonderful job, for, let's say, the mayoralty of Karachi or ombudsman or something, and we put up two candidates, George W. Bush and Osama bin Laden, be truthful, who would win a popular vote in Pakistan?
I think they'll both lose miserably.
President Musharraf of Pakistan and a whole lot of laughter, but it's serious business here. Barnett Rubin is with us, senior fellow at New York University's Center on International Cooperation. Sanjay is calling right now from Toronto, Canada. Hi, Sanjay. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. Well, here's my question. You know, President Musharraf is a dictator. When he came in, there was a coup when he came in, he couldn't find a local or domestic constituency, right? So, and he's wooed the radical Islamists, and they have wooed him because they see an opportunity in each other.
I mean, he's not the first, but he certainly has done some of that. So you sound like you've got an Indian perspective. How do you see it?
Well, it's not necessarily an Indian perspective. It's a subcontinental perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that, I mean, we have to go further back into you know, what's motivating the kind of radical renegade elements within Pakistan. You know, the ISI is partially out of Musharraf's control. He's trying to...
This is the intelligence service in Pakistan, yes?
Yes, is out of control. The radical Islamic elements who Musharraf sides with domestically, who then side with the Taliban and al-Qaeda. And the middle of all this is the fact that the U.S. is not well-regarded in Pakistan because the U.S. has treated Pakistan like a football ever since the independence of Pakistan. You know, and of course, it was part of the sphere of influence of the United States, and India was part of the sphere of influence of the Soviet Union, and ever since the end of the Cold War, the whole thing has collapsed, but all the actors are still in place.
And the great game going on, and it's a tough one. Barnett Rubin, how do you pick apart these issues of fundamental Pakistani issues here, Afghan, Indian, and then running through that, this threat of Islamic extremism? Does the international community have to solve the whole ball of wax, which has been such a problem for so long, before the extremist piece can be solved?
Well, that's a question that those of us involved in this issue have been asking ourselves for a long time. Is it possible to stabilize Afghanistan as long as Pakistan still feels threatened by India? But we have to take it step by step, and we shouldn't get the idea that we can solve all the problems in the world and then there'll be eternal peace.
Yeah.
But just with regard to what the last caller said, of course, it's not that General Musharraf personally wooed the militants. The Pakistani military has based its power for decades on an alliance with Islamic parties because the only counterweight that it has to democratic legitimacy, which seems to be the preference of most of the citizens of Pakistan, is Islamic legitimacy. So that military governments, where they are headed by very secular people like General Musharraf or General Ayub Khan, or that they're headed by very religious people like General Zia-ul-Haq, have all made these political alliances with the Islamic parties. But at the same time, now some of the Islamic parties are criticizing General Musharraf because of his alliance with the United States, which is unpopular there, and because he has not really allowed civilian politicians to have that much power.
Mm-hmm. There we are. Dallah is calling from Hebron, Connecticut. Dallah, you're on the air.
Hi, sir. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an Afghan American,
okay.
And I grew up in that whole conflict. And the war against these terrorists, we cannot win it the way we are fighting.
We cannot win it? You say why?
Yeah, because President Bush said that you are with us or you are against us. And that worked at the beginning with President Musharraf. Pakistan has different agenda in Afghanistan. In United States and its coalition, not to in Afghan government, they have different agenda. Pakistan wants to destroy Afghanistan and be dependent of close allies to Pakistan.
So what about the events of this week, Dallah? Do you think, is there some hope in this meeting at the White House last night, or things headed in the wrong direction?
No, sir. That's a wrong direction, and it was an insult to President Karzai to be together with in the same room and at the same table and have a dinner with President Musharraf.
Wow, so there's a grim view from the Afghan-American perspective. I want to bring one more voice in here, if I may. Dallah, thanks for calling. With us from Tucson, Arizona, Hussein Haqqani. He's professor of international relations at Boston University, author of Pakistan Between Mosque and Military. Hussein Haqqani, thank you for being with us. What's the game, if I may use that word, that you see President Musharraf playing in the U.S. in this last week?
Well, General Musharraf primarily wants to assure the United States that he's their ally. And if you remember, he's been talking in the first person. It's I, meaning I am the one who's your ally. I am the one who is going to deliver anything, if anything, in the war against terror. It's not about Pakistan. His agenda is threefold. One, he wants continued U.S. support that will ensure his own power base within the Pakistani military. Second, he wants to continue with Pakistan's foreign policy, which is primarily aimed at containing India rather than anything else, and exerting influence over Afghanistan. And his third objective is to make sure that the United States does not consider him as untrustworthy. And that is the agenda with which he has been in the U.S. for the last 1 week.
Okay, so he's juggling a lot there, but is the end result going toward or away from regional stability? What about Pakistan's stability itself? I mean, there's even talk about Pakistan as a potential failed state. How high do you see the temperature, the risks at the moment?
Look, Pakistan has been on the brink of failure longer than anybody can remember. It just keeps afloat because of aid from the United States. Its economy floats whenever the aid is high. Its economy sinks whenever the aid levels are low. Unfortunately, it's not a country run by institutions except the Pakistani army, which won't allow political parties to function, which won't allow the judiciary to develop. And then, to top it all, it has a strategic agenda, which is a little far greater and bigger than most people in the United States realize. It wants to see Pakistan as the hegemon in relation to Afghanistan. It wants to have strategic depth, it says, vis-a-vis India. And it certainly is not interested, the Pakistani army is not interested in ending tensions with India anytime soon. So it's a constant juggling act. And as with all juggling acts, the fear of failure is always there, although failure has not come yet.
I want to bring one more voice in, if I may, from Washington for just a couple of minutes. We've got Ruth Wedgwood. She's professor of international law and diplomacy at Johns Hopkins University. Ruth Wedgwood, thank you for being with us. Do you see a risk of Afghanistan falling out of the win column for the United States in President Bush's war on terror framing, or has it already?
Well, it's a time when we have to pay a lot of attention. I mean, there is an evident and perceived spike in activity by the Taliban with elements of al-Qaeda in the southeast of Afghanistan. And we both have to harden Afghanistan and also, I think, try to persuade President Musharraf of Pakistan to be as cooperative as he can. We need to build up the Afghan National Army. We need to worry about the problem of corruption in some of the southern provinces of Afghanistan and give Hamid Karzai the confidence to go after governors who are not properly handling their own villages and populations.
The ones who haven't been assassinated. You know, let's just pull the varnish off this for a second. Let me just ask a blunt question, Ruth Wedgwood. Do you see, I mean, Iraq, we're talking about potentially civil war and potentially sort of losing that arena. Now Afghanistan's got this new instability. Could the U.S. Agenda sort of end up losing in both Iraq and Afghanistan?
We're not going to lose in Afghanistan if we pay attention. I mean, the original battle plan was quite brilliant. In fact, the ability to balance of power among warlords at the beginning of the reconstruction was really very well handled. But the problem now is weak ministries, and at times President Karzai, I think, worries that we're not going to be there for the long run. The substitution of NATO forces in the east of the country has, in fact, multiplied the force that's available, but we need to provide confidence that we're in for the long term.
Ruth Wedgwood saying be in there, inspiring confidence for the long term. It's a tough situation right now. Ruth, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure, thank you.
Let me take a call from Alexandria, Virginia. Abo is on the air. Hi, Abo.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I'm originally from former Soviet Union, Uzbekistan.
Okay, nearby, and, yep.
Yeah, and just wanted to make a comment about the jihadistan. To be honest with you, it really makes sense to someone like myself because jihadistan, in my opinion, will grow once the former Soviet Union republics, such as in Central Asia, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and especially Uzbekistan, will fall after the dictators are gone. And they have a lot of... lenience towards the jihadi movement because of the dictatorial powers there. And if I could make a suggestion to the government of the United States, I think it would be much better if the United States and West actually invest not only money but efforts to win the minds and hearts of the countries just like Uzbekistan, because once it is fall, then it will be just a big mess, and it will just, pour more fuel into fire.
Abo, we hear it. You pulled the curtain back even wider for us. Hussein Haqqani, what about this jihadistan idea? Here Abo calls in and says, you know, look beyond Afghanistan and Pakistan. If you're not careful, you could have a real sort of wild situation right across borders in this area. Is that the risk we're looking at as you see it?
I think that risk is very much there. Look, the Pakistani tribal areas are discussed a lot and everybody says they are under nobody's control. But the truth is, the people in the tribal areas say a few years ago, 26 years ago, the Americans funded the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence. The ISI officials came to them and said, look, jihad is a good way of getting rid of evil. At that time, the evil was the Soviet Union. Weapons poured in, money poured in. The Arab jihadists came with an even harder line agenda, people like Osama bin Laden. And then we developed family ties with them. We gave them our daughters in marriage. We took their daughters in marriage. And now they are our relatives. People from Uzbekistan came in. People from Chechnya came in. So that whole area essentially has already shifted to a jihadi mindset. Can the jihadi mindset be turned off like the tap? General Musharraf thinks that he can ride the tiger. But I think that the tiger is likely to devour not only him, but also the region. It's important to try and unwind the jihadi mindset and offer alternatives, both in economic, social, and political terms to the people.
But right now, it seems to be spreading, not unwinding. Doug is calling from Stratham, New Hampshire. Hi, Doug, you're on the air.
Hi. And I believe it is spreading. And I think we have essentially a feudal society, warlords out in the outlying regions, local interests, as in the Pashtun in the Hindu Kush, which is a cross-border group. And what is the U.S. military's role in this? I see that European news agencies report just after the bombing plot was uncovered that Pakistani intelligence pointed to the Hindu Kush, the area just north of Kabul, as the area in which this attack was staged and planned. The 10th Mountain Division sticks their nose up there, and what happens? Casualties and no collateral damage reported. It seems to me that we are frittering away and just kind of have no, the Central Command has no clue how the political agenda relates to our military presence. Could you please comment?
Let us pick that up. Barnett Rubin, again, quoted in Newsweek at least, General Eikenberry seems to be very plugged into this, saying we can only do so much with military power. What is your sense of the deployment of that power, the dance between military and aid? I mean, the budgets coming out of Washington have been steadily shrinking on the aid front.
Yeah, well, first, the airline plot was not plotted anywhere in Afghanistan. It was plotted in Pakistan. That's quite clear, though General Musharraf likes to say it was in Afghanistan. As I said, what the military understands is that this is not primarily a military issue. It is primarily political, economic, and social. And that's true for the tribal areas as well, as Hussein Haqqani was saying, because those tribal areas now, they have a combination of jihadi infrastructure built up by the Pakistan military with U.S. and Saudi assistance, plus military presence. If you want to start to, as he said, unwind that jihadi culture there, those areas have to be actually integrated into the Pakistani polity and society. There are no schools there except for madrasas. There's no employment there except for jihad and smuggling.
But that sounds like such a tall order. And are the resources even begun to be put toward that? I mean, are we really addressing the fundamental problems here?
Tom, let me come in on this.
Yes,
please. If I may, Barnett. All I'm saying is that one cruise missile costs $1 million. How many schools do you think you can build with $1 million there? It's a matter of cost effectiveness. I think the United States Congress must look at that. How much money is it willing to pour in into development? But more important than that, the military can locate enemies and liquidate enemies. Who is the enemy has to be identified politically. And if there are elements in Pakistan that are trying to take advantage of this, then we should not bluff ourselves into believing that they are allies. And the same goes for Afghanistan.
Is there a fuse burning here, Barnett Rubin? Is there a time factor? Is there a point at which there is a jihadistan that you can't just woo your way back into, but you have to fight your way back into, that becomes a base for a threat to the U.S. again?
I'm not sure it's useful to conceptualize it in that way. Look, this is an area, the tribal areas, it's not an area where you can win a military victory. It's never been done. I don't believe it will be done now. But it's not an area where people are indifferent to politics and economics.
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, political parties are illegal there. Actually, the whole area is run under these regulations that were promulgated by Lord Curzon in 1901, you know, and not by a modern legal system at all. There are political parties in Pakistan who, if they were empowered by a genuine democratic system, want to implement those reforms that would make that possible. But the military will not allow that because it's contrary to their interests as an institution.
Hussein Haqqani, we've just got a few seconds. Is the United States and NATO, is the international community up to the complexity and depth of this problem, or is this thing slipping away from us as it did from the British, as it did from the Soviets?
Well, I think that they could be up to the task if they are only willing to listen to people who know the region, who know the area. Unfortunately, decisions in Washington and now increasingly in Europe are being made based on ideas that are just paper ideas that have no relationship. People talk about, you know, let's eliminate poppy. How are you going to eliminate poppy without offering people an alternative economic opportunity? And so relate it to the ground reality, and maybe you can do it. If you don't, there's trouble ahead.
A narco state, jihadistan, and complexity of a depth that's kind of, it's hard to imagine it being.
And don't forget the nuclear weapons, Tom, which Pakistan has.
We're going to have to come back to it. We're very grateful to each of you, Hussein Haqqani of Boston University and Barnett Rubin at New York University. Thank you to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.